This is continuing coverage of United States versus Sean Diddy Combs from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
It was the week before one of the most high-profile federal trials in recent memory, and a key government witness, someone expected to take the stand and help connect years of alleged abuse, control, and sex trafficking, just disappeared. No warning, no explanation. One day, she was telling prosecutors she was ready to testify under her real name. The next, radio silence, and with that, the prosecution's carefully curated lineup took a hit before the jury had even been selected. This isn't a side character we're talking about. This was Victim 3, one of only four accusers named in the indictment against Sean Diddy Combs. She wasn't anonymous like the others. She wasn't reluctant. She was, until very recently, all in. Not just testifying, but doing it publicly. She had dropped her Jane Doe status, agreed to be named in open court, and was reportedly prepared to detail what prosecutors described as decades of sexual exploitation at the hands of one of the most powerful figures in the music industry. That kind of testimony doesn't just support a case like this, it defines it. Because when the federal government brings racketeering and sex trafficking charges under RICO, they're not looking to paint a portrait of one bad night or one unfortunate relationship. They're building a pattern, a system, a criminal enterprise with a beginning, middle, and end. Each victim's story is a brick in that wall. Take one out, and the foundation shifts, and that's exactly what happened here. In late April, just as both sides were preparing for trial, Victim 3 made what looked like a pivotal decision. She informed prosecutors that not only was she willing to testify, but she was ready to do it without a pseudonym. She was reportedly going to step into that courtroom and give her story in her own name. For prosecutors, this was a big moment. It meant she was ready to be cross-examined, to face the jury, to endure the scrutiny that comes with being part of a nationally watched trial. But within a matter of days, everything changed. By early May, just days before opening statements, prosecutors told the court they had lost contact with her, not just a missed call or a delayed email. Total silence. They couldn't reach her, and they couldn't reach her lawyer either. During jury selection on May 5th, Assistant U.S. Attorney Maureen Comey stood up in federal court and told Judge Aaron Subramanian point blank, they couldn't find Victim 3. She was officially unresponsive. The defense naturally pounced. If this witness was going to be used, they wanted to know. If not, they wanted her out of the picture. Judge Subramanian, in the kind of tone only federal judges can master, directed prosecutors to make every possible effort to track her down. He didn't issue a material witness warrant. He didn't force a delay. He just told the government to keep trying and to keep the defense in the loop. By May 7th, just 5 days before opening statements, the situation hadn't changed. She was still missing. No calls, no emails, no messages through her attorney who, according to prosecutors, was dealing with personal issues and not responding either. That's a problem. Now, let's be clear. This isn't someone who skipped town the night before trial. This was a witness the government expected to be central, someone they had presumably prepped, someone whose allegations were distinct from the others. She wasn't there to echo what Cassie said. She was going to tell her own story, one that, according to reporting, stretched over a much longer period of time and involved its own episodes of alleged control, coercion, and abuse. So when she vanished, that narrative vanished with her. By May 12th, the first day of trial, the prosecution made their decision. They didn't name her. They didn't outline her allegations. They didn't even mention her by her designated pseudonym. She was out. Quietly dropped from the case presentation. Not formally dismissed, but completely absent from opening statements. And if you weren't reading the docket or watching court coverage closely, you might not have even noticed. But inside that courtroom, everyone noticed, and not just because of the drama of a disappearing witness. The legal strategy had to change. The prosecution was originally prepared to build a multi-victim, multi-decade case, an enterprise built on multiple victims, multiple patterns, and multiple reinforcements. Now, one of those pillars was just gone, and they had no clear reason why. To be fair, prosecutors didn't accuse anyone of wrongdoing. They didn't suggest that Combs or anyone else had tampered with the witness or threatened her. They just said she was unreachable, which in the world of federal trials, especially one involving a celebrity defendant and sexual abuse allegations, is still a big deal, because that kind of absence raises questions the jury may never be able to ask, but will absolutely think about. And it's not just about optics, it's about evidence. Victim 3 was supposed to help solidify the RICO narrative, to tie together themes of coercion, financial control, and sexual exploitation with another independent thread. Without her, the prosecution has fewer stories to point to, less pattern, less breadth, and the defense knows it. So they pushed. Diddy's legal team asked the government to make a final call. Was she going to appear or not? Was her testimony coming, or were they bluffing? Prosecutors gave no timeline, no confirmation, just an acknowledgement that they were still trying to reach her, and they didn't know if she would show. At that point, she might as well have been a ghost, and the government was left standing in a courtroom with an empty chair they had once expected to fill with testimony that could shift the jury's understanding of who Diddy allegedly was and how far his reach extended. It's not the first time a key witness has vanished in a high-stakes trial. It likely won't be the last. But in this case, it happened at the worst possible moment. After she had agreed to testify, after preparations had been made, and just as the narrative was being built in front of 12 jurors tasked with deciding the fate of one of the most powerful names in music. The witness was gone. Her attorney wasn't talking. Her story, at least for now, was silenced, and the prosecution was forced to pivot, quietly reshuffling its strategy to rely more heavily on the voices still willing to show up. When a witness disappears from a federal trial, especially one involving allegations of sex trafficking, the consequences aren't just logistical, they're structural. Everything about how a case is argued, how a jury perceives its scope, and how the legal system itself responds gets reshuffled. That's exactly what's happening now in the federal prosecution of Sean Diddy Combs, where the absence of one of four alleged victims, referred to in court as Victim 3, has created a measurable vacuum inside the government's case. Her story wasn't just expected to complement those of the other accusers. It was part of the spine of a RICO prosecution that hinges on proving not just what allegedly happened to one person, but that what happened was part of a larger, repeatable pattern. And now it's gone. In a federal criminal trial, a missing witness means more than a canceled testimony slot. It means that unless certain legal thresholds are met, the jury can't hear a word of that person's story. There's no transcript reading, no video deposition, no secondhand summary from an investigator or a therapist or a friend. Not unless the defense had a chance to cross-examine her previously. Or unless prosecutors can prove the defendant caused her absence, neither of which, according to court filings in the public record, has happened here. So whatever Victim 3 may have said to investigators, or even to prosecutors, is now functionally irrelevant. It's inadmissible. That alone shifts the courtroom landscape. The jury has no access to her allegations. Her story, if she told it at all, can't be used to build the prosecution's argument. It's like removing a scene from a movie that wasn't just important for character development, it explained the plot. And this particular story matters because of how the charges were structured. This isn't a single-count sex assault case. The charges against Combs include racketeering and sex trafficking, both of which require prosecutors to prove conduct that extends beyond a one-time incident. The racketeering charge, in particular, calls for a pattern of criminal behavior, a coordinated enterprise that involves multiple victims, events, and means. Each victim's testimony is one thread in that tapestry. When you pull one out, the tapestry doesn't necessarily fall apart, but it does start to thin. With Victim 3 gone, prosecutors are now relying on the remaining women, Cassie Ventura and two Jane Does, to carry the full burden of establishing that pattern. Those women are testifying about serious, graphic, and highly detailed allegations. But the loss of an additional voice inevitably narrows the prosecution's reach. Instead of hearing from four alleged victims covering a span of decades, jurors are now hearing from three. One of them, Cassie, has already settled a civil suit with Combs. The other two remain pseudonymous. That's not disqualifying, of course. Courts recognize the value of protecting vulnerable witnesses, particularly in sex trafficking cases, but from a narrative perspective, from a strategy perspective, and from a jury psychology perspective, it matters. Because jurors notice who's there and who isn't. They don't need to hear a judge say, victim three is gone. They can infer that when the prosecution introduces a victim in opening statements and never follows up, or worse, when they don't introduce her at all, that silence carries weight. The defense, while barred from explicitly naming absent witnesses or speculating on their disappearance, can still highlight the gaps. They can ask pointed, technically innocuous questions like, you've only heard from three accusers. For a case about a criminal enterprise, don't you expect to hear more? And they can press that idea further in closing, under the umbrella of reasonable doubt. Ladies and gentlemen, the government says this was a pattern, but where's the rest of the pattern? They're not breaking any rules by asking those questions. They're doing their job. And unless prosecutors find a legal foothold to bring Victim 3's story into the courtroom, an admissible prior statement, a qualified recording, or proof that Combs or someone acting on his behalf caused her to back out, it's going to stay out. Forfeiture by wrongdoing, the legal doctrine that allows a witness's prior statements to be used if the defendant caused their unavailability, doesn't apply here. Not unless prosecutors can show evidence, emails, calls, payments, threats, that links Combs to Victim 3's disappearance. And so far, they haven't made that claim. And in fact, they've been very careful not to. Publicly, the government has only said that they lost contact with her and haven't been able to reach her attorney. They haven't implied witness tampering. They haven't requested a material witness warrant. They haven't even floated the idea that she might be in danger. From a courtroom perspective, it's a dead end. And under federal rules of evidence, that means her absence is just that, an absence. The prosecution can't fill in the blanks with implication or emotion. They have to move forward without her. Which brings us to the ripple effect, how this loss reshapes the architecture of the trial. Without Victim 3, the prosecution loses not only a set of allegations, but also the power of corroboration. In a case where each victim described a unique but overlapping pattern, drug-fueled sex, alleged violence, coercive control, the presence of a fourth accuser strengthens the reliability of the first three. When multiple people who don't know each other tell similar stories, the likelihood that they're all making it up tends to shrink. It's not proof, but it's persuasive. The fewer accusers you have, the more weight each one has to carry on her own. And that's not always fair to the victim or to the case. It also changes how the trial is remembered in public. Jurors are insulated from press coverage, but the court of public opinion is wide open. The media has covered Victim 3's disappearance extensively, pointing out how prosecutors lost contact with her after she initially agreed to testify. That kind of headline doesn't disappear. It lingers. And while it won't be cited in court, it will shape how the case is interpreted outside of it. This isn't the first time a federal case has lost a key witness. In R. Kelly's 2008 trial, the absence of the alleged underage victim who chose not to testify was cited as a major reason for his acquittal. In that case, jurors said they just couldn't convict without hearing directly from the person at the center of the video evidence. Years later, when that same woman finally testified in a separate federal case, Kelly was convicted. The difference, she showed up. And that's the unspoken reality here. When a victim doesn't testify, their story doesn't just lose weight, it often loses its legal standing entirely. The justice system isn't built to make assumptions. It's built on cross-examination, on evidence, on procedure. And unless those rules are followed, the system doesn't allow their voice to be represented in any way. So that leaves prosecutors in a tough spot. They have to move forward with fewer witnesses than they planned, fewer bricks in the wall, and no way to explain to the jury why one of their star accusers simply never appeared. That's not a fatal flaw, but it's a shift. one they didn't ask for and can't do much about. Now the pressure moves to the witnesses who are present, to Cassie and to the remaining Jane Does. Their stories will have to do more. Their credibility will have to stretch further, because the case now rests entirely on them. And as the trial moves forward, the weight of what was lost in that empty chair grows heavier, not just as a tactical concern, but as a reminder of how fragile these prosecutions can be when even one person goes silent.
She was a doting mother, the kind who baked cookies, made the best homemade Halloween costumes, and never missed a PTA meeting. The perfect mom. Until the police found something buried in the backyard. A secret she kept for years. A secret she thought would never come to light. The neighbors gasped. Not her. She's so nice. But people forget. Monsters don't always look like monsters. Some wear aprons. Some tuck their kids in at night. And some hide their darkest deeds in places they think no one will ever look. If only someone had heard the warning signs, had recognized the patterns from an eerily similar case on Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. If they had only subscribed to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, they could have listened ad-free before anyone else and saved themselves from baking cookies with a serial killer. Instead, well, they won't be RSVP to this year's PTA meeting. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.